Welcome to the Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast, where you get multifamily investing made real. Learn from top players in the real estate investment world as they share their secrets with you and discover proven strategies on apartment investing that actually work. To learn more about Wheelbarrow Profits, visit jakeandgino.com, your one-stop shop for everything multifamily. Now to your hosts, Jake and Gino.
Hello, everybody. This is Jake Stenziano, host of the Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, the chef, the father of six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbaro. Gino, how's it going?
Mr. Stenziano, doing good. How you doing, bro?
Always making it happen, big man. Today's guest is Jay Heinrichs. Jay started in real estate in 1975 at the age of 18, and he was a broker by the age of 20. Since then, he's bought, sold, and lent money on real estate. So without further ado, Jay, welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys. Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. And let's get this thing kicked off. Tell us a little bit about getting started at that early age in real estate and how that went for you.
Well, I grew up in a real estate family. My dad was a landman in the old days. If you've ever seen the movie, I'll think of it. But anyway, he sold land, and I grew up in that business. And I wasn't much after high school. College didn't interest me, and he encouraged me to get my real estate license and give it a shot. And since I kind of grew up with him, and I rode with him in the car all the time and listened to his sales pitch for years and years and years, I basically could sell real estate by the time I was 12 years old. So at 18, it was a no-brainer. And for 60 days, I had a couple escrows, and I just never looked back. I mean, it was just very much a natural for me.
Oh, the movie
was Glenn Ross. That was the movie. My dad was a landman, just like those guys. Yep.
So tell me the transition. You got into selling real estate. I mean, did you ever transition into landlording and into owning commercial and into, like, building? What was the transition for you?
Well, for me, it was mainly sales, and I didn't really get into landlording and owning residential properties. I skipped all that and basically was doing land development. So we were buying blocks of land or what we call shadow plats, and then we were putting all the streets and roads in and then selling the developments off. So I pretty much did most of that through my 20s, and I don't think I bought a investment property, quote-unquote rental property, till well into my 30s, if not late 30s. I was mainly in development and value add and make as much cash as I could. To me, at that point in time, the rental business was just too slow. There was not enough action in it for me and not enough money, given the ability to take and leverage money and go buy a piece of dirt, you know, and 10x it. So that's kind of what I concentrated on in my early career.
So let me ask you, what markets were you doing this in?
California, Northern California, and then Oregon, Portland, Oregon. I developed about 500 lots in Portland from 92 to 2002.
So in our market of New York, that was hot back then, 20, 25, 30 years ago. That is non-existent right now in where I am in New York. Have you seen that happen where you are? I mean, what happened during the downturn of 2008? Did you see that business just drop off and then just pick itself back up?
Exactly what happened. Although in the Portland market, we didn't have, because we have a what's called an urban growth boundary, which is an artificial anti-sprawl line that goes around the city. Mm-hmm. So you really can't, you know, do what you do out in the Midwest or down in the desert or California, where you could get way ahead of yourself and you ended up with all this inventory. So there was not a lot of hangover inventory here. It only took the Portland market about 2 or 3 years to absorb the failed projects that failed in 08. By 2011, it was all gone. And the banks were still very hesitant to lend again. So no one prosecuted any new maps from 2006 to about 3 years ago, other than the very biggest players, Lennar, Horton, somebody like that could pay cash for it. Mm-hmm. smaller players like us that rely on bank financing, we were kind of froze. I got my first development loan from my bank about 3 years ago, and we've been doing one to two projects a year since then. So we're pretty blessed to have bank financing on our projects. It makes all the difference in the world.
So what did you do in those few years? I mean, can you just give me a picture of what led up to 2008, and then what happened after?
Prior to 2008, about 2001, 2002, I got out of land development, because what happened was is the big players came into Portland and they really squeezed us little guys out, us 40 to 50 lot a year guys out. And so the margins just went to nothing, and I reverted back to my hard money days. You know, I skipped through the late 80s. I owned a hard money company in Oakland, California, from 89 to 92, and I sold it and came to Portland. But I decided to get back into hard money lending in about 2001, 2002, and got that going. And that's what I was doing between that time and 2008. So by the time I started, we started with about our first line of credit with $4 million. We had to have 20% equity, so $1 million in cash, which we had. So we started with $5 million. I rolled that up to close to $35 million by 2008. And then, as you know, anybody who was a lender in 2008, 2009 took severe beatings. I was not immune from that. So 2008 to 2010 was basically, I didn't work. I just did workouts, you know, losing money hand over fist. So it wasn't until about 2011 that I started to regroup, and the my partners in the hard money company, they kept the money, that company going, but it wasn't big enough to support all of our incomes, and I was ready to launch into my next phase.
So, Jay, what did you learn during the downturn? I mean, everyone has their own story. I mean, what did you learn during that 08, 09, 2010 that you can apply, I guess, going forward?
Well, you know, I'd like to say I saw it coming, but I didn't. I was actually, when it all happened, I was on a cruise in the Mediterranean watching the BBC, and it's like, holy shit, when I get home, this is not going to be good.
Oh, man.
So, anyway, you know, what I learned was if you take credit out of the marketplace, it doesn't matter what you are, where you are, whatever. If there's no credit, things just start to crumble. And it's like people will ask me, I said, you know, how many $75,000 Suburbans are going to be sold if they had to all be paid for in cash, right? So that's what happened to real estate. And so it just came crashing down to a number where the cash people that were sitting on cash were able to just, you know, they were stroking checks. There was a time there when 50, 60% of all the sales were for cash, you know, in that 09, 010 period. And our model was what they call on bigger pockets, the BRRR model. I put people into title with my hard money loans, and then the takeout was to refinance, and they were going to keep the homes as rentals. Well, when rental mortgages went bye-bye, so did our exit, and we got stuck. So, you know, if I learned anything, you know, you got to have multiple exit strategies. And it just, you know, even I was in my stuff 65% LTV, but, you know, some of the markets out there that we were in, the values dropped, you know, 80%. And it doesn't matter who you are, you lost money.
So fast forward to now, what are you focusing on right now in this current market?
Well, what I did is I started in 2011 buying up rental homes. I bought about 350 of them. And then I rolled out of those in 2013. And I got back into my I came back into my hard money type lending procedures with, instead of lending to the public like I used to do in my hard money company, where, you know, the turnkey company would bring me a buyer and I would lend to the buyer. Mm-hmm. Now I only have about 10 or 12 clients that I do business with, and they are the turnkey companies. So, and they have the exits for me, and there's multiple exits. They can either sell to a client, they can refinance, and I also have a refinance product for them that I semi-control, so that gives me a little more safety in what I'm doing. And then on top of that, when you dig into how the BRRR method worked for turnkey companies prior to 08, what happened was is when I made my 65% loan to value loan, everybody got paid.
Mm-hmm.
That paid for the asset, that paid for the rehab, and that paid for the profit for the turnkey operator right on my hard money loan. So everybody got their money out of it except for me. Right. And then what would happen was the buyer would do a 75% rate and term refi, and they would usually pull $4,000-$6,000 worth of tax deferred cash out of it, and they'd usually buy four homes at once, so they would get $20,000, and it worked. I did a couple thousand of them. I mean, you know, there was no reason in that the 6 years prior to 08 thinking that it was all going to melt down like it did. So, So in this version of what I do, nobody gets paid until I get paid. We all have a payday on the same day, and that's when we've exited the asset, either to the end buyer, the retail buyer, or the turnkey company wants to keep the asset for themselves. And I have clients that do that, and but there's nobody makes any money up front anymore like they used to.
So, Jake, talk to me about the turnkey model. What are your thoughts on the turnkey model?
Well, I have as much experience as anybody probably in America. I mean, I started in 01, 02 financing this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of them either went out of business or restructured 08 to 010 because of, you know, everything came to a screeching halt. The turnkey business by 2010... turned towards SIDRAs, self-directed IRAs. So most guys were just selling for cash because there was no financing. And as long as, you know, I'm pretty straightforward with, you know, my opinion of rental properties outside of the West Coast and in the Midwest. For people that are don't live in the market, I'm all about, you know, A and B class, the C and D class, forget it. Don't even go there. C class, maybe-ish. Maybe you get lucky, maybe you don't. So as long as they're buying the top end of the rental, so if you have top end rents in a market at, let's say, $1,000 to $1,200, it's kind of where it peaks. Mm-hmm. As long as they're buying rental properties that are renting for $1,000 to $1,200, they're creaming the top of the rental class. When they go into these inner city areas and they're buying rents at the bottom 20% of what people can, you know, the lowest rent. So let's say the lowest rents are $500 to $650. So when they buy those type of assets that rent for those type of dollars, those can give them fits down mm-hmm. to not working and losing their money. So that's and there's turnkey guys that operate in that, and most of the people that buy that stuff don't know any better. You know, it's their first buy, and they're just looking at pro forma. They're just looking at, you know, numbers on paper that aren't based in reality.
Those numbers look so wonderful sometimes. I mean, you look at those things, and your cash on cash is fantastic. And I just always tell Jake, those things go vacant 1 month, and you have a turnover, and you got to put $3,000 into the thing to turn the unit over. Your projections are gone for the next 3 years. That's one of the problems that I see with turnkey. There's no spreading your risk. You have a couple of small little assets there, and it can be tough when you first start out in that business. That's what I see, one of the, I guess, well, not pitfalls, but one of the issues with turnkeys.
Well, it doesn't even have to be turnkey. It's buying a rental property at the bottom of the market anywhere in the Midwest, in Rust Belt, mm-hmm. anywhere. Mm-hmm. Almost anywhere you're going to, you know, even out here on the West Coast. It doesn't matter if you bought it yourself or bought it from turnkey. It has mm-hmm. to do with, you know, the neighborhoods and the locations. I mean, believe me, I ended up owning 250 houses in the Midwest. I had to live there for a year. And it's very depressing when you roll up onto your asset and it's been stripped. There's no copper in it. The air conditioner is gone. The HVAC's gone. The water heater's gone. Kids have tagged it. You know, so you just have to stay out of those neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
If you go into those neighborhoods, you're taking a risk. And but if you go into the better neighborhoods, you know, where you're getting that top end renter, you're mitigating those risks, exponentially. And a lot of it is, if you look at the rents, so if a rental is $500 a month in some little town in Ohio, it's common for them to use either 2x or 3x gross income to qualify for that rent. So someone has to make between $1,000 and $1,500. They're paying $500 for rent. They're paying $150 for utilities. You know, they're living on less than $1,000 a month total to run the whole household. I mean, mm-hmm. That's why they're so vulnerable to not paying rent. Any little thing that happens to them, they're out. You know, they have a hard time.
Car breaks down and they're screwed. Yep.
Right. So when you take someone who's paying $1,200 for rent in one of those markets, and it's normally 3x the rent, they're making $3,600, and now they have $2,400 a month to live on. That gets more realistic.
Never thought of it that way. That makes total sense. What markets are you currently?
I'm in right now. I'm all over the Midwest. I'm in Pennsylvania quite a bit, throughout Pennsylvania, Florida. I'm in South Carolina. South Carolina, I'm building houses. I'm building 400 to, I got one going that's going to be like $2.2 million, but $400,000 to $600,000 infill specs. And then in Portland, I'm building subdivisions here. I'll build probably 42 homes this year. And those will be from 400 to a million each.
Oh, wow. So, I mean, you've had all this experience seeing market cycles. At what point of the market cycle do you think we're in right now?
Well, I think we're, obviously prices have rebounded back to, they're almost equal to the highs. But I see affordability. When I look at interest rates, though, the interest rates are almost half of what they were, back when the last run-up happened. Rents have gone up, especially here in Portland, to support it. So I don't know, as long as interest rates don't go skyrocketing up and as long as jobs are there, I just think it's going to – I think we're kind of coming to the end of our run-up of appreciation. I think we're bumping on that now. But as for predicting in 2 years everything's going to melt down like 08, I don't see it. It's just what happened in 08. Well, like for me, just a little guy, I had $35 million worth of loans out where nobody had any skin in the game. Today, I have, close to $20 million out, and everything I have is at wholesale, and nobody's got any money until I get paid. So I learned a lesson, right?
I was just about to say, what a great, at least, my father used to say, if you make a mistake the first time, it's on, not a big deal. If you make it the second time, then there's something wrong with you. So you really learned a lifelong valuable lesson. That's awesome, actually, to be honest with you. I think that's great.
Yeah. No, I looked at what all went wrong in lending, and then I reverse engineered my new model to make sure I didn't have what happened to me the last go around. And and I would say, I'm 95% to 97% profitable on my deals. I'll have a couple that don't work, but I'm also doing on that side of the coin, I'm doing probably 250 transactions a year. So if I can get through there and only 10 of them are bummers, I'm happy.
That's not bad. I've got to ask you this question. I know you're not into the multifamily space, but I've got a lot of students who call up about the Portland market. And when they just give me those cap rates and those multifamily per unit costs, how are they making money in multifamily in Portland?
Well, it's been a run-up in the last 3 years. You know, the Portland market, the rental market here had been very stable for like a decade. There'd been no movement in rents. And it's only been in the last 3 years where rents basically doubled, and went up 50%. And so that's led to some rent control measures and stuff like that starting to happen in the city of Portland. But I think people look at, when you look at rental property here as well, there's, you know, less than a 1% vacancy factor, so you don't have any downtime. There's literally no HUD. So you're, you know, everybody's at market rent. Your renters have, you know, they got to have good credit scores and good jobs. So you're not, you just don't have a lot of, risk of not getting your rent, right? So when mm-hmm. you buy something, your income is very consistent here. And very predictable. And so I think you just, you know, you get the bigger, institutional type investors that come in that are looking for, aren't looking for the highest return necessarily. They're looking for consistency and, you know, quote unquote, you know, investment grade type purchase. Kind of like the same buying in LA or San Francisco.
So you're basically still building in Portland. That's where you're focusing on a lot of your land deals right now, correct?
Yeah. I'm, you know, for me personally, I'm all about, you know, I'm at the age now, cash is what's important to me, and I'm all about just, you know, creating as much cash as I can. And the best return on investment for my dollars is leveraging into new construction where, you know, I can make a 100% plus APR on those. So that's what I'm doing.
So if you had a young kid, I've got a lot of people always ask me how to get into real estate. You were actually born into it. I mean, what would you tell an investor? Because I'm sure you get this asked a lot on Bigger Pockets. How do I get into real estate? What's the best way for me to get into the business? Well, how would you you know, give them an idea how to do that?
Well, you know, I'm totally biased. I mean, I got my real estate license, and like I said, I didn't invest in real estate for decades after I started. I was all about earning a good living for my family and being able to own a house and everything, you know, and on the West Coast, you know, houses are quite a bit more money than they are in a lot of other areas of the country. And so you had to make a lot of money to own a home. And so really that was the goal. It was to get a primary residence in the Bay Area, you know, and then everything had to go from there. But I think as it relates to, you know, like the online social media stuff, you have kind of two schools of thought there. You have investors wanting to get into the game, and they think they want to what they call wholesale property. I'm not a big proponent of that. I think that's, you know, maybe one out of 10 or one out of 100 will actually do it for more than a year or more and actually make any money at it. Plus, I see the state's totally cracking down on it. Most of it is selling real estate without a license, so it's not really legal.
New York's tough. You're right. I agree with you on that. New York's a difficult state to do that in.
Yeah, Florida's doing that. California's doing that. Oregon just passed added to their code that you need a license to transact in equitable interest. It used to be the wholesalers would hide behind this, oh, you have an equitable interest so you can sell your advertise your contract. Well, Oregon just, boom, changed the code to include equitable interest. You need a license. of course, people violate it all the time, but, you know, it takes, people can unwind deals and they can turn you in and so forth and so on. But anyway, starting out, it seems to me if I was going to be wanting to be in the multifamily space, I'd do everything I could to go work for one of the biggest and best multifamily brokers out there. And I look at a friend of mine here, Steve Borlaug, who he rented me an office about 15, 18 years ago. And he was with Norris Bakes and Simpson just as a young 27-year-old guy wearing his suit and tie and everything. Well, he's now in charge of their whole financial, he runs their whole money thing and is doing exceedingly well. And so you know, make money and then go ahead and you're going to be immersed with all the guys that are in the business of buying and selling that stuff. And then you can invest with them. Maybe you broker a deal and say, hey, I don't need the commission, but I'll take a 1% interest in it. I mean, I've done a lot of that over the years, where I work for free, but I take an interest in the project.
We like that.
Yeah. So there's ways to do that. And you guys know multifamily way better than I do, but the little bit that I do know about it is you talk about a good old boys club. I mean, you know, when you have a broker that has a multifamily property, he doesn't advertise it. He takes it to his group first, right? His pet buyers. If he can't double end it to his pet buyers, then he opens it up to the rest of the office. If they can't sell it in the office, then they maybe put it on LoopNet or CoStar. And then the last place they would do it is, you know, the multiple listing service in the given market. So I think it's all about getting into where the deals are made. And then I think a lot of the young kids now, you know, they read all this stuff and they're influenced by, hey, you can get rich in real estate, blah, blah, blah. But they don't understand the apprenticing part of it. You know, it's just like me. I was selling $5,000 lots, making $500 a hit when I started. You know, I didn't know anything about real estate. That was an easy transaction. And then you grow into it. So it's either that or you know, you're like a bunch of my clients down in the Bay Area that made a pot full of money working for the high tech companies, and they have high incomes, and they can fast forward right into being an investor.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have those kind of incomes, and you're on a limited income, seems to me you want to go work in the industry and make commission. That's what I would do.
I like that. That's what I did.
Yep.
You are not a self-proclaimed social media person. So, I mean, this question might be a little bit more difficult, but what is your, you know, how do you find the best way to network? Because, I mean, real estate is all about networking. And nowadays, everyone just thinks about Facebook and LinkedIn. And, you know, what ways do you like to reach out to people and, you know, start building rapport and networking with other people in your industry?
Yeah, I'm going to be so far off base. I don't have LinkedIn. I only use Facebook to look at my grandkids. The only social media I do is BiggerPockets because it's easy for me to use. I know how to use it.
Uh-huh.
And it's a lot of newer people, so I can just kind of relate my antidotes there. For me to get business is, one, I have a name in the industry. And mm-hmm. so I have a very deep Rolodex, and I just call people that I already know. And if I'm looking for somebody new, I stalk them first. I find them, and then I get on the phone. And it's tough now because you got to go to their stupid websites, and then you got to go to their squeeze page, and then you got to go to the secretary who's going to try to. And then I got to get on there and say, no, I'm here to help your owner, you know, grow his business. I have some financial products he may like. And then if I can get past them, then I get with the owner. And then if I can get past the first phone call, I jump on the plane and go out and meet them. That's how I do it.
It's a long process, huh, Jake? Not like the good old days, right? You just get on the phone and someone would actually pick up the phone, right, and answer the phone. That don't happen no more.
Yeah.
Get through those gatekeepers.
The problem with the social media and all that stuff, I mean, I tried it a little bit, but boy, you don't know who these people are. And for me, I'm more peer-to-peer. I'm not interested in dealing with the general public anymore. I'm only interested in like you two would be clients of mine. Other people that own real estate companies that are doing stuff that need capital or need my financing or whatever. Those are the people I set up programs for them. And then they're the ones that sell it to the retail folks, not me. I'm just I'm in the background. By the time the folks might have bought something, they already own it by the time they figure out it's me. Like I've had people, there was somebody who bought some of the stuff that I funded out in the Midwest that lived like five blocks from me. They're going to look at that. They're going to see me and they're going to go, oh, there's Jay. I wonder what he did.
I like that.
A lot of times, you know, we're table funding, you know, seller carry back type stuff. So it's just like when someone gets a loan with the bank and they get a letter 30 days later, hey, your loan's been sold to NationStar. Well, that's me. I'm buying that loan, right?
I got it. I guess my last question, Jake, over here is, we want you to know, ask you, what is your best real estate investing advice or tip for the listener?
Well, that's a tough one. I have my biases for sure, like we've just talked about. I would say one thing is to, depending on your experience level, if you have limited experience, to me, you want to be as conservative as you can. I see people get hurt when they chase the, oh, I have to make 20% APR, otherwise it's no deal, right? Mm-hmm. So be a little more conservative when you're starting out. And then once you've got more experience and you have some capital, you know, you can start to take bigger risk. You can start to get into more development type deals, joint ventures, syndications, all that type of thing. And then I think a lot of the professionals out there, the high earning professionals that have no time for all this, there's a lot more opportunity for them than there was 20 years ago, where, you know, you have the crowdfunding, you have the successful syndicators. So as long as they don't just blindly jump into those deals and they do really good due diligence on whoever the sponsors are. And in my mind, the sponsor is as important, if not more, than the asset. Then they can jump on board with somebody and have a nice long run with them, you know. Mm-hmm. But you still can't invest blindly. You have to definitely check out who you're doing it with.
Jay, you've been in the business for a while. Just in general business terms, what is your best day-to-day habit for success that keeps you going and makes you successful?
Well, one is communication, and this is a huge pet peeve of mine with the way things are done today. I don't text, I won't return them, and I won't text. And if someone texts me, they're not going to get a text back. I think it's too impersonal. I answer my phone, and my emails are all returned the same day I got them, unless they come in at like 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and I'm reading or something. So communication is number one to me, for anybody. And that's just my upbringing in the sales business. Because when you are in the sales business and you're late calling a client back and the client says to you, oh, man, if you would have called me 2 days ago, I bought this $100,000 property over there. Sorry, you missed out. You have that happen to you a few times. You learn to, respond. So one, that's just a major pet peeve of mine, is the real estate community and everything hiding behind, they never answer their phone. For faster service, text me. Well, I'm not going to do business with that person, but I'm old school, right? And so that would be one of my main things, is just, man, be on your communication. If you're starting out and you're selling or you're trying to do any kind of transactional business, I think, being proactive and getting to people immediately is critical.
Sales was my first career, and I still consider myself a salesman, and I've always been a student of sales. And the one thing that kills me is I don't have the natural sales ability of some other people, but where I see them fail is the follow-up. And so you really kind of hit something there with me, because I was always like, look, if I do everything I can and I follow up, I usually will win versus someone else. And then they drop the ball because they don't follow up, and they rely on, I just am a friendly guy, I have the best relationship kind of thing. So I think that's a super important thing to mention there. I think a lot of people in sales are not as successful as they could be because of that. So that's a great point.
Well, and punctuality. My dad taught me this. If I had an appointment at 7 o'clock for an in-home presentation, he would be, okay, we'd get there at like 5 to 7, and we'd be sitting in the car waiting. This is usually in San Francisco in the little row houses. And at about 22 seconds, we're out of the car, And right when that second hand hit seven, boom, we handle it on there. And then the people come to the door and they go, wow, you're really on time. And then you'd go, yeah, don't you want to do business with someone who respects your time and is punctual? And boom, you're right away, you're selling, you're closing them.
That's right. That means everything, because that really does mean you're respecting someone else's time. And that means a lot. And a lot of people aren't like that nowadays. It just drives me nuts. You know, I mean, it's just like, you got to call at 7, get on at 7. There's no reason, you know.
My business partner in the timber business, we couldn't have been more opposite. Unless it was going salmon fishing or elk hunting, he was always made the bell. After that, never on time. So one time we were having our, and I finally got tired of it after about 8 or 9 years, we were having our normal 10 o'clock a.m. meeting, which he usually rolled in at 10 to 10:30, 10:45. I didn't show up. And all of a sudden, they're like calling the cops. Jay's not here. Jay's not here. It's not like Jay. I'm just like, okay, I could be rude too. But anyway.
Hey, they're not taking it like that, though. What has been an influential book that you've read that you'd like to recommend to the listeners out there?
Well, I don't read a lot of business books. Reading to me is more for relaxation and, you know, that type of thing. But my dad fed me a lot of motivational stuff as I was growing up. I liked Jim Rohn. You know, I liked Think and Grow Rich. I enjoy going to Zig Ziglar and those type of folks. To be honest, I haven't read a business book in 20 years.
You know, if you read Think and Grow Rich, you've read just about every business book that's come out since then, because they've all been spin-offs, so I think you're doing okay.
Well, I started on, and I probably will finish, Gino Wickman's stuff. And the only reason is my wife was a trainer for Floyd. And back in the day, if you know who Floyd Wickman is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of...
I know Gino Wickman.
Connection.
Who's Floyd? I'm sorry.
Floyd's his dad. His dad.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay.
Floyd was one of the original gurus. He would have been a contemporary of Robert Allen, of Dave Del Dotto, those guys. Only Floyd taught real estate agents how to sell.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. That book made the book from Gino Wickman made a big impact on me when we were starting to scale our business. And I recommend that to anybody. I think that's
yeah,
very
I've read about half of that. I'm going to go ahead and finish it. But I'm not a big, I don't know. I just, you know, like I said, I'm more of a social reader.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm not saying I know everything, but I'm pretty well ensconced in what I do for a living and just trying to do that well. So
sure. What project are you excited about right now?
Well, I'm super excited about what I'm doing in Charleston, South Carolina, and I'm very excited about my projects here in Portland, Oregon. I got a new one, 23 homes, that I'm starting, and I'm building the exact same house and model.
Is that Charleston or Portland? Which one's that?
Charleston, South Carolina, and then the 23 homes I'm going to build are here in Portland this year.
Gotcha.
And the exciting part about that is the exact same floor plan and house and everything on the exact same lot that I was selling a year ago for $350,000, $360,000. I just got my appraisals in for my construction loans, and they came in at $430,000 to $440,000.
Oh,
and
wow.
I bought the dirt 3 years ago. And so I'm in the dirt. I got Lennar offered me double my money on the dirt. So I could walk with like $1.2 million tomorrow if I wanted to take it. But this is going to be extremely, extremely profitable one to build out. And we can do it in a year. And then in Charleston, virtually everything I've built there sold before it's done. And I just like it. It's historic. Wow. I have a great GC there that's, you know, works for us and does a great job.
The Charleston, I was curious about, you have to adhere to, you know, certain types of architecture there within the city limits?
We do. It's called the bar, and it goes from neighborhood to neighborhood. We have a fourplex. It'll be my first multifamily there. We bought a fourplex. It's a major gut job, and then we can build a fourplex behind it. And we just got that through the whole architectural thing. It took about 6 months. And then I just closed on a high-end lot in the most restrictive area, which is the historic district. If you've ever been there, they have the lamps with the gas lamps, and you can take the horse and buggy. Well, I found
the pretty shutters and everything like that.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so that stuff's all like $2 to $10 million per house, and I snagged a lot for $570, and we're going to build a house on that. And I figure it'll take me 6 to 7 months to get it through the architectural committee.
6 to 7 months. Yeah. Wow. Sounds like New York.
Yeah. And the land use, the architect, it's $40,000 just to do that. when plans I hear at Oregon, I buy them off the shelf for $2,000 and I'm off and running.
Wow. Jake, I was saying before, it must be a good feeling to be able to tell Lennar to fly a kite with their double offer. You know what I'm saying? That must be a really good feeling. Just say, I'm keeping the project. I'm doing it myself. I want to make bank on it. You know, that's going to be a great feeling.
It is. It's part of it's like, and I'm just confident in my bank, you know, my bank's confident in the Portland market. That's why they're going to loan me all the money to do it. And as well, my bank is also, if we did run into a problem, these homes would cash flow, and my bank would give me a 5-year loan on them to hold them if we ran into a, you know.
That's great.
Not going to get, yeah. So I don't borrow hard money.
That's the multiple exit strategy, though. You've got the other strategy out there. That's what's going to make you successful. That's what's made you successful, and that's what you learn from. If one doesn't work, you've got a backup plan. I love that.
Well, the other thing is, and why this is an important little tidbit I get asked about a lot, is people are always rate shopping banks and looking, and you know, they don't. In my mind, they don't treat their banker with the how important they really are. And my banker and I have been together for 24 years now, and he saw me through the recession where most banks would have kicked me to the curb, right? And when they started to do infrastructure loans, I got their first loan they did in 8 years. And so I had a BP member call me, oh, I'm looking for construction money, you know, down in by the Eugene area, and I'm looking for a cheaper rate. And I said, well, what's your rate? He's building a $3 million multifamily. Oh, it's 5%, but they want, you know, they used to let me have 10% down. Now they want 20. And I'm like, shoot, I'm paying 1.6%, but that's great money. And if they've taken care of you all this time, why are you shopping them? And so to me, I would rather, I'll pay a little bit extra, but I know if something goes wrong, I'm going to fall back on that 22-decade relationship, and I know they have my back. They're not going to be, oh, he's not a good client of mine, I'm just going to kick him out and foreclose on him. That happened to a lot of people in the downturn. So to me, as long as I'm not getting totally gouged, which I don't think 1.6% was totally gouged, and we're making, you know, $100,000 a house, why shop it just to get a half a point, you know, 0.5% less?
Gina.
I agree. Yes.
Gina.
Yes.
I think he's telling me I got to take our boy Saporito out for a candlelight dinner tonight. Maybe we've been a little too rough.
I think so.
Well, it's just like the guys that I finance out in a small way. You know, there's companies out there that I've created them, and they're like family to me, and hopefully they think I'm that to them, and we're a very important cog. So, you know, and they, so we all prop each other up and stand behind everybody. So,
but Jay, this is
all about relationships.
Yeah, exactly. This is where I take exception to the internet, where I don't like the internet and what's happened in our business and other businesses. Money's become a commodity. So everyone just shops for the best price. And even with our real estate education, everyone shops for the best price and for cheap. And you go in bigger pockets, everyone wants stuff for cheap or for nothing. Well, what do you get when you get cheap or nothing? You get cheap. You know, what do you get when you get the best price at the bank? You don't have the relationship. I mean, part of the having that relationship with the banker Jake talked about is when we have a potential deal, we know we have financing financing locked up. We have the confidence that we know that guy's going to give us a loan, and we can go and we can make a really good offer on the property. I don't know what that's worth. I think that's unquantifiable. But the internet has made it such a commodity where everyone's lending money, and all they're worried about is the terms and the rate, and there's no discussion about, well, let's form some kind of relationship. So I think you make an excellent point.
Well, the other thing is with the continuity, you know, my banker automatically gets my financials every year. He knows my CPA. It just happens automatically. I'm not having to put a whole big package together to go out and try to find new money. They make it very easy for me. I mean, yep. He knows my business as well as I know my business. And we're just giving him quarterly reports, and he's got them all there. He might call me one day and ask for this document or that document, but that's it. And we're just able to keep rolling. The other thing that's going on, and I know you guys have seen this, especially with the newbies out there, the newer folks, somehow they've got it pumped into their head that private money is out there just falling off of trees, and there's a lot of rich doctors that will just love to loan money at 5%. And so they waste an inordinate amount of time trying to find the unicorn private money. And there's a huge amount of crooks out there just making money off these folks $500, $700 at a time, telling them, oh, yeah, you're approved. Send me $500, and you're going to have this private money. Only to lose the $500.
$500 to get in the club, pal.
Yeah. But they don't know what they don't know, right? They've heard all of
that. See, I didn't know that because we've never really shopped private money or something. So I didn't even know that, to be honest with you. That's scary. That's scary.
Or you put a little want thing on Bigger Pockets. Hey, I'm looking for some private money. You'll get 10 private emails from crooks all over the
world. The wolves started to come out of the bushes, huh?
Yes.
They can smell
just like
blood.
Just like you see on Facebook. You know, I have 3% money, 30 years, no money down, no personal guarantee. All you have to do is actually pay it back, and we'll loan it to you. You know, they're just a bunch of crooks. It's just a Nigerian scam is all it is.
Buyers beware here.
That's right.
Yep, exactly.
Guys,
so that would
awesome.
Be, you know, when you ask that question, when it comes to money and doing your deals, I think relationships, continuity, as long as it works for your deal, is more important than saving, you know, half a point or, you know, a couple basis points just to try to shop your best deal. I understand on when you're doing multifamily and cash flow stuff that's a fixed cost over a long period of time, and so that's more important. But in my business, where I'm in and out of deals in 9 months, you know, what's $1,000?
It's still a fair point, though. Even on something, you know, on some of the smaller multifamily stuff that we've done, you know, I totally can relate to what you're saying. And having the financing in place, not having to go shop, do the dog and pony show, know the terms that you're going to get, it totally makes sense. I think that's a very good takeaway.
Yep.
I was going to say, if you want to, we can put this out there. Would you like, or is there any reason for listeners to get a hold of you? Maybe if someone's looking for private money or anything, would you like to put your information out there or not?
No, I'm not really looking, like I said, for any retail type places to put money. What I am going to roll out, though, and if you want to talk about this, I see there's a need or a niche for, because I've been getting a lot of hits for this, is someone's in between deals or, you know, they don't want to lock up for a long time or they don't want to be, you know, for whatever reason, they have some short-term money. So I'm gonna roll out a product for investors that have cash for basically a 60-day call product. And I would talk to folks that would have $100,000 minimum and looking for, you know, a short-term place to put their money with hopefully someone they think they can trust, which would be me.
So,
and they can get a hold of you on Bigger Pockets, right?
Yep.
Pardon me? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They can get a hold of you through Bigger Pockets, correct?
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. Well, guys, it's been really fun, interesting show. And if for the listeners out there, if you guys found value – on the show, please, you know, subscribe to the iTunes page, leave us a review. And Jay, thank you very much for your time today.
Hey, I appreciate it, guys. Have a good one. Take care.
Thanks, Jay.
We trust that you enjoy the Wheelbarrow Profits podcast. Visit jakeandgino.com, your one-stop shop for everything multifamily. See you next time when Jake and Gino share more of their investing secrets with you.